We've been discussing reading verses and commentaries from chapter 11 of canto 10. That's Krishna's childhood pastimes in Vrindavan. Specifically Vrindavan because when Krishna was 3 years and 4 months old, they had been, he, Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda had been living in Gokula. Gokula is on the eastern side of the river Jamuna. And there had been some disturbances. Putana came, Shakatasura, the cart demon, came. Krishna pulled down two trees in the courtyard of Nanda Maharaj, and they felt, thank God, he's protected our dear son, and so forth. And so there were too many disturbances, and they decided, let's consider maybe there's a better place, less difficulty, less disturbance. And so they went to Vrindavan Forest, which is on the western bank of the river Jamuna. So they crossed the river with, on bullock carts with all their possessions, etc., etc. And their reasons were three: safety for the children, better for the cows, because where the cows had been walking for 3 years, 4 months, all the ground was, the grass was eaten and the earth was trampled, and so they wanted a new place for the cows. And the third is, it was safe. At least they thought it was safe. At least there's no wild animals, and it's under the protection of the king in Mathura. So they shifted. And then that's where the chapter begins, and Krishna's childhood pastimes in the Vrindavan forest. So there's lots of description of what little boys do when they're 3 years, doing little boy things. And, you know, specifically, although he's the personality of Godhead, the cowherd boys had affection for him without any regard for his being the supreme personality of Godhead. They just, they're in the intensity of their, Sakyabhav, the friendship feelings of love, were just very, very, very strong. So playing and playing and playing. Meanwhile, in Mathura, the capital of that district, Kamsa was planning to kill Krishna. Oh, so as he had sent earlier or previously had sent demons, Vatsasura is described in this same chapter 11. Vatsa had a shape-changing power, so he assumed the form of a little calf, because there was a question by Kamsa, what is Krishna most attached to? And the answer given was the calves. So he called Vatsasura, who knew how to assume forms, assume the form of a calf and attack Krishna when he's least suspecting. So Krishna knew. Vatsasura showed up one day, and right away Krishna knew, and he pulled Balaram to the side. You see that calf? That's not a calf. That's a demon. And Balaram was, oh. So they made a plan. And Krishna took care of Vatsasura, little boy, 3 years, 4 months of age. This is pretty small, but Krishna was strong. So he, there's details, but, well, one of the details is he had a plan. He called the cows, and as they, the calves, and as they came forward, he started scratching under their chin and rubbing their head. And they were going, more. So then the calves one by one would come. And then Vatsasura figured, this is my chance. So he came forward and Krishna went quickly behind him, grabbed him by his hind legs and his tail and started whirling him around. And because his mystic power lost its strength when his life died, life left him, he assumed this huge demoniac form. Krishna whirled him around, threw him on the top of a kapita tree for practical purposes, because there were kapita fruits that the boys liked to play with. So some kapita fruits fell, and the boys were happy to have kapita fruits and said, yay, nice going, let's have lunch. So then at a later time, they traveled in the same chapter 11. They traveled northwest from the Vrindavan forest to Nandishwara, or the ancestral home of Nanda Maharaj. There was a lake, and by the side of the lake they saw something they had never seen before. It looked like a mountain peak that had been knocked over by a thunderbolt. And then they got closer, and it wasn't it. It was some kind of an animal. And they were curious what it was. They were a little afraid. Krishna came right up. It was Bakasura. So we're reading that section right now. And as if he didn't know, although he knew, he got close to Bakasura. Bakasura tried to swallow him. He got him in his, he had a crane, Baka. And he put him in his beak. Krishna was having fun. He allowed him to go in his beak, but he couldn't swallow him. And then Krishna made his body really hot, like fiery hot. So Baka spit him out. And when Krishna was in the mouth of the crane, the cowherd boys and Balaram fainted, because this is now the particular message, is they're so attached to Krishna, he's their life. And when their life was in the beak of this big beast, they were not only afraid, not only froze, they fainted. And Balaram too. And then there's all this discussion that Balaram is omniscient, as is Krishna. So he knew Krishna's all-powerful, but his affection was so strong, it just overwhelmed what he knew. And he also fainted. And there's this similar reference, or reference to a similar circumstance much later in Dwarka, when the marriage to Rukmini was being arranged by her elder brother, Rukmi, because the king, Bhishmaka, wanted his daughter to marry Krishna, and Rukmi wanted his sister to marry Shishupal. And Rukmini was, no way, I'm not going to marry Shishupal. I want to marry Krishna. Because she had heard about Krishna from Narada Muni, and she gave her heart to Krishna, so she wrote a letter, dear Krishna, help. So Krishna came. And when Balaram heard that there was all these armies, Jarasandha and Shishupal and fellows with their armies readying for the marriage, and Krishna's going to come and try to kidnap Rukmini, he heard about it. His brotherly affection, because now at this stage he's in the older brother role, whereas when they were younger, they were just like boyfriends. He was very concerned for the protection of Krishna, although he had already seen, before going to Dwarka, he had seen Krishna single-handedly defeat Jarasandha's entire army 21 times. No other soldiers on the battlefield. He knows Krishna is all-powerful. But his affection for Krishna is so strong. In this case, he assembled from Dwarka, sent a whole army, huge, vast Yadu dynasty army to protect Krishna. And then there's a similar example given when after the Kurukshetra battle was over and Maharaj Yudhisthira is installed on the throne as the king, and Grandfather Bhishma's passing takes place, Krishna's getting ready to go back to Dwarka from Hastinapur. And Yudhisthira knows Krishna's divinity, but he has such affection for Krishna that he sent a huge army to protect Krishna. Like, he needs protection. Krishna is their protector. But the idea here is the mood of love in these elevated devotees is so strong that it eclipses their understanding of his divinity, and especially so in Vrindavan. That's the main theme that we've been going over. So now we'll go to chapter 11, starting, we're just going to cover three verses. We'll start with text 51. And this is still in the midst of the fight with Bakasura. Didn't bring my glasses. Okay. When Krishna, the leader of the Vaishnavas, saw that the demon Bakasura, the friend of Kamsa, was endeavoring to attack him. This is after he spit him out. He's now with his beak trying to attack him. With his arms, he captured the demon by the two halves of his beak, and in the presence of all the cowherd boys, very easily bifurcated him, as a child splits a braid of virana grass. It's a certain type of grass. By thus killing the demon, Krishna very much pleased the denizens of heaven. And the commentary reads, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, grasping firmly his beak, he tore Bakasura apart like a blade of virana grass in front of the eyes of the boys, giving the devatas great joy. Another commentator, Jiva Goswami, writes, Krishna squeezed the demon, who was a friend of Kamsa and thus most powerful and most wicked. Since Krishna was the goal of the devotees, Satam Gati, killing the demon was appropriate. The goal of tearing the demon apart is explained, namely, since the Lord punishes the demon to protect the devotees. From Bhagavad Gita, Pritranaya Sadhuna Vinashaya Chuduskritam. That's what he comes for. Sambhavami Yuge Yuge. The phrase, quote, friend of Krishna also suggests that bifurcating the demon, it was as if Kamsa was bifurcated. And because Krishna was the shelter of the devotees, Satam Gati, he protected the life of Balaram and others. Since Krishna was the very life of the boys, it should be understood that when he came out of Baka's mouth, the boys all regained consciousness. They fainted. And then when he came out of their mouth, they regained consciousness. That's the way that he protected them. Virana is a type of grass, and Krishna split him like a blade of that grass. The conclusion is this, quote, Krishna's thinking, no one should think that Vatsasura, the calf, approached me, not knowing my powers, and being inattentive to my powers was killed very easily, without being able to do anything. In order to make everyone understand that even if the demon knows about me, and even if he is attentive, he cannot do anything, even if he shows all his unlimited powers. To give joy to his friends, he then entered the demon's mouth. By Baka's death, the devatas were benefited. They became joyful. Baka's miserable end is also hinted by this. And one further commentary. In the presence of all the cowherd boys, Krishna firmly grasped Bakasura's beak and bifurcated it like a blade of grass. This action greatly pleased all the demigods. So next verse, we're just going to cover 3. This is text 52, chapter 11. Translation reads, at that time the celestial denizens of the higher planetary system showered Malika, Pushpa, flowers grown in Nandana Kanana, Indra's garden, upon Krishna, the enemy of Bakasura. They also congratulated him by sounding celestial kettle drums and conch shells and offering prayers. Seeing this, the cowherd boys were struck with wonder. Purport or commentary reads, Vishwanath, they showered flowers everywhere. They praised him with ancient verses. Jiva Goswami writes, the devata's joy is described. They showered flowers completely, some akiram, so that he was covered in jasmine flowers from the Nanda garden, flowers most treasured by the devatas. They profusely praised him with verses and the sounds of drums and conch shells for killing Baka. They also praised with verses such as Purusha Shukta. His friends were astonished, filled with the highest bliss on seeing the good fortune of their friend, since they were sons of cowherd men whose knowledge of Krishna's greatness was covered by their intense affection, and who took his well-being as their very life. And another commentator, Sanatan Goswami, writes, by the devata's celebration, the cowherd boys inferred that Baka must have been very wicked. As sons of the cowherd's men, the boys had respect for the devatas. So, within Braja, they're followers of Vedic culture, and from time to time they would worship various devatas. The understanding of their worship of the devatas is they were connecting themselves with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We were discussing this morning, just a little sharing. It is known that Srimati Radharani regularly went to Surya Kund and worshipped Surya Dev. But when she was worshipping Surya Dev, she's Krishna's internal potency, and for her there's only one object of love and worship. So she was worshipping Surya Narayan, not just the sun god. Similarly, in 10 chapters later, there's a description of the young unmarried gopis worshipping Katyayani to get Krishna as their husband. There's a vrata during the coldest month of the year, the month of Magh, December, January, when Vrindavan is really cold at night. So the young girls had this vrata that every morning, before the sun came up, they went together to the side of the river Jamuna, and they offered prayers to Katyayani, worshipping Katyayani, to get Krishna as their husband. And then they bathed in the river. So it's the commentary describes that Katyayani, there's a demigoddess Katyayani who is a form of Durga that persons worship for something material. But you can't worship something material to get something spiritual. So they were worshiping the spiritual counterpart of the demigoddess Katyayani, in the form of the internal potency Katyayani. You with me? The saying is there, as above, so below. So in this material creation, that's the below part. And it's a reflection of what's the above part. Like chapter 15 of Bhagavad Gita speaks of a tree where the branches grow down and the roots grow up. No such thing. But it's a reflection. So when there's a pond or a lake or body of water, and then the opposite shore there's a tree, and the reflection is upside down. The branches down, the roots up. So that's the material world. Upside down. It's a reflection. So whatever exists here has its spiritual counterpart, is the point. Whatever energies exist here have their spiritual counterpart. Whatever personalities exist here, there's a spiritual counterpart. So the demigods that exist to control the affairs of the universe, they have their spiritual counterpart. So to have the personality of Godhead as one's husband, that can't be granted by a demigoddess, or anything material can't produce something spiritual. So their worship was actually of the internal potency Katyayani, because through the internal potency Katyayani, one can get Krishna's association of any kind. Or there's another elaborate description. When during Shivaratri, the residents of Vraja went to a temple of Shiva and Uma to perform some rituals for Shivaratri. But they were worshiping him as the foremost of the Lord's devotees. But Vaishnavana Mutar Shambhu, so etc. 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 They follow Vedic culture, but they're on the highest platform of consciousness, so they don't follow it to achieve something material because they have only one interest, and that is Krishna. We've been reading verses that are describing the what Goloka is like, the spiritual world, Krishna Loka. And in Krishna Loka, the scriptures describe all the trees are wish-fulfilling trees, kalpa vriksha. Not only a particular type of fruit, but any type of fruit or anything of any quantity in any season. There's those kalpa vriksha trees. And the land is made of chintamani, which is a spiritual touchstone. It can fulfill a wish-fulfilling. All the land is wish-fulfilling. All the buildings, all the everything. All the cows are kamadenu trees, cows. They not only supply milk, they supply anything. So the idea is, in the spiritual world, practically anything can supply practically anything. Or everything can supply practically anything. But they don't have any desire. Material desire. They don't have anything desire for themselves. They have just one desire. Their loving relationship with Krishna. And they have duties connected to their loving relationship with Krishna. And that's their life. That's their life. So the cowherds have respect. The boys, these are little boys, 3 to 4 years old, around Krishna's age. And their families have respect for the devatas. So here they're seeing the devatas showering Krishna with praise. The musical instruments and flowers and hymns from the Vedas. They're going, wow. But the way they process it is, if he's so special and we're his dear friends, we must be special too. The little boys, they can't see his divinity, because their affection is so strong. That's the main point. The cowherd boy smiled in a special way, since the flowers from the Nandana garden were nothing compared to Vrindavan's flowers, and the sound of their music was nothing compared to the sound of Krishna's flute. The praise of the devatas was nothing compared to the praises of the people of Gokula. Thus, it was not such a grand festival. On the other hand, some of the cowherd boys, Krishna's dear friends, were very expert in all these matters. So now we're going to the next verse, text 53. Just as the senses are pacified when consciousness and life return, so when Krishna was freed from the danger of being in the mouth of Baka, all the boys, including Balaram, thought that their life had been restored. They embraced Krishna in good consciousness, and then they collected their own calves and returned to Brajabhumi, where they declared the incident loudly. And this is Prabhupada's purport. It was the practice of the inhabitants of Brajabhumi to compose poetry about the incidents that occurred in the forest when Krishna performed his different activities of killing the asuras. They would compose all the stories in poetry or have this done by professional poets, and they would then sing about these incidents. This is written here that the boys sang very loudly. When we visit Vrindavan, one of the places that we visit is the birthplace of Srimati Radharani. Very special place. It's not commercialized at all. It's just kind of off in an agricultural field, and there's the palace or the house where Vrishabhanu and Kirti Da lived, and Radharani was born there. Ravel is the name of the place. It's in Gokul. It's on the eastern side of the river Jamuna. So we go there real early in the morning, and you know the deities are just being woken up. It's really nice. And one time we went there, got there very early. I went by car, and the buses were still coming. So over in the field, it was harvest time. It's in October, Kartik. So it's harvest time. And the village people were in the field cutting the wheat and then thrashing the wheat. And it was like a festival. There were like, I don't know, 50 people. And they were singing songs of Krishna. You could hear, I don't know Hindi. Or that, I don't know, they were speaking maybe some other dialect of Braj or something. But it was very clear what they were doing. They didn't have musical instruments. They were just doing their agricultural activities. Singing, you could hear, they didn't need amplification because they were all singing. And they all knew the words. And just singing songs about Krishna. It wasn't Bollywood songs, it was songs about Krishna. It's very, very pleasing. You know, it was really nice. I was really charmed. So that's what they would do. And you know, to some extent, although it's Kali Yuga, it's being still carrying on. So back to the story. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes in his commentary, getting back, Krishna, who was like their life, pranam iva, the boys, like enlivened senses, embraced him and gathered together the calves, returned to their home. Gathering together the calves, returned to their homes. In loud voices, they proclaimed the killing of Vatsasura and Bakasura. Or the meaning can be setting the descriptions to melody and rhythm so they could sing them on other days. Also, they sang songs of the incidents. Jiva Goswami, his commentary reads, this verse shows the boy's affection. Attaining Krishna close by, who had come to their place, they embraced him and became filled with bliss. They embraced him tightly out of great affection because he had been freed from the mouth of Baka. This was a sign of their great bliss. At first they approached Krishna on their own, but then they were unable to do so because of complete weakness. Thus Krishna came to them. That is, the understanding is, they fainted and the energy had been drained from their body seeing Krishna in the mouth of Bakasura. So when Krishna came out of the mouth, they were still weak. They wanted to go to Krishna. Krishna knew their difficulty. So he went and embraced them. Loving exchange. The example of prana is appropriate. He was their life, and when he came close, they revived. As on other days, without regard for time, they had the calves return home. Seeing the state of their protectors, the calves had scattered here and there in distress. The boys collected the calves, and then, glorifying Krishna, and glorified that Krishna had killed Baka. In beautiful voices, they loudly described what he did with joy mixed with reverence. The boys had not spoken previously how Krishna had killed Vatsasura, since a calf should not be killed. And they feared that no one would believe that the calf was a demon, so they didn't say anything. This was discussed in Gopal Champu when Krishna pointed out to Balaram, see that one? Yeah, I see that one. He's not a calf. He's a demon. Oh. And I think we should kill him. And when Balaram is saying, well, if you kill him, people will criticize because you're not supposed to kill a calf. So when they see that he's a demon, they'll understand it's okay. Okay. So they're concerned with observing social etiquette and decorum and even little boys, you know, diplomacy. So in the past, they didn't express it. But today, however, they related that incident. The cowherds recount this incident in a later chapter, 26. Even though Shukadeva Goswami made no mention that the boys told them, expressed this in a previous verse. Out of prema, Shukadeva Goswami forgot to mention this. Anyway, Vishwanath writes, just like enlivened senses, the boys regained their lives, pranam iva, when Krishna returned from the clutches of the demon. Balaram and the boys embraced Krishna and then collected their calves to return home. They loudly proclaimed the killing of Vatsasura and Bakasura, a second meaning. The cowherd boys set the descriptions of these pastimes to poetic melody and rhythm so they could sing them on other days. We're going to cover one more verse. When the cowherd men and women heard about the killing of Bakasura in the forest, they were very much astonished. Upon seeing Krishna and hearing the story, they received Krishna very eagerly, thinking that Krishna and the other boys had returned from the mouth of death. Thus they looked upon Krishna and the boys with silent eyes, not wanting to turn their eyes aside now that the boys were safe. Short purport, Prabhupada. Because of intense love for Krishna, the cowherd men and women simply remained silent, thinking of how Krishna and the boys had been saved. The cowherd men and women looked upon Krishna and the boys and did not desire to turn their eyes aside. So this is, again, this intense affection. Different rasa. It's first it's the boys, now it's the elders. The gopas and gopis, honored by seeing their beloved with eyes thirsting to drink the nectar of his beauty, glanced at him, looking over his whole body for fear that he may have been wounded. Jiva Goswami writes, hearing this, the cowherd men and women were surprised. They were attentive to Krishna for his protection with great affection. They looked at him with attachment. They could not stop looking at him for a long time because their eyes could not be satisfied. They glanced with attachment and affection as if he had returned from death. The word eva, or as if, is used because they thought he had returned from death, or it was like a friend returning from death, being separated from him during all day. They longed to see him, but on hearing that he had killed Baka that day, they became particularly attached to him and gazed at him more intensely, which was part of the purpose. Krishna stimulating the love of the devotees in Braja by performing pastimes where there's some apparent danger and then the danger is taken. So it just increases affection, intensity. Sanatana Goswami writes, hearing this, the cowherd men and women were surprised and immersed in great affection. They gazed at him with attachment. This means that they had become blissful on seeing from him for a long time, not seeing him for a long time, because their eyes were never satisfied fully. The reason for looking at him with attachment and affection was that it was as if he had come back from death. They thought in this way because of great affection. Last paragraph. The elder gopis were astonished. Cha here means but. They were distinguished from the cowherd men by their intense prema. They were respected by Krishna, who was most dear and precious, as he glanced at them. Thus they gazed at him with longing, with unsatisfied eyes. During the day in separation, their eyes were thirsty for seeing him, and on hearing that he had killed Baka, they especially gazed at him with attachment. So yesterday or the day before, on the same section, we heard that this verse from Bhagavad Gita, the three reasons Krishna gives to Arjuna why he appears from time to time. Pritranaya sadhunam, to give protection to the devotees. Vinashaya cha duskritam, to diminish the disturbance of the duskritis, the demons on the earth planet. And to restore dharma, dharma sangstha panartaya. Sambhavami yuge yuge. So it's part of Krishna's purpose in appearing in this world is to diminish the burden of the demoniac kings. That was Mother Earth's appeal to the demigods, and they went to the shore of the Milk Ocean and made that appeal. So Krishna agreed to come. So he's doing what he does when he comes. Those, the demoniac influences are diminished. And the those who are in the mode of goodness, they're elevated and protected, and dharma is restored. So the commentary is saying when these events of Krishna's killing demons in Braja, it's kind of routine, or it's secondary. It's fulfilling one of his purposes in coming into this world. But for him, the main purpose in coming to Vrindavan is to exchange loving dealings with his devotees. So this other is kind of incidental and routine, and they celebrate it and they talk about it. But the main thing is their loving exchange. So the loving exchange may center around these events, but the loving exchange is the essence. And there's two or three times a day, according to what the Acharyas describe. The primary demons are described in the 10th canto, but there's unlimited. It's so many, many, many on a daily basis, just like the description is there. Their principal avatars of the Lord, they're described commonly in scripture, but the all scripture also says how many? As many as there are waves in a river or waves in an ocean. That's how many. That's a lot of incarnations of the Lord that appear. But the principal ones are described. So the principal demons that were killed are described. But it was a routine affair. It's like, you know, brushing your teeth or something. It's just something you do every day. So Krishna killed demons every day. But the main activity was loving dealings, and especially the other highlight here is the intensity of the affection is such that of the residents of Vrindavan in particular, that they just could not see Krishna as God. They could not get themselves to see him that way. And whenever he would exhibit something that was an expression of his divinity, it simply served to intensify their feelings of love. Not like we know from Bhagavad Gita, for example. Arjuna asked Krishna to show his universal form. So Krishna shows his universal form. And then he says, you know, I was thinking of you as an ordinary, I made many offenses. We interacted with one, this is in chapter 10. We interacted with one another as friend and sitting, reclining together and so forth, but you're the personality of Godhead. So recognition of the divinity of Krishna may diminish the intimacy. But the resident of Vrindavan, their intimacy is so strong. Nothing can penetrate it. It just overrides or eclipses any sense of his majesty and divinity and opulence and power. Although he shows it from time to time, their love is very special. And therefore, because of their love for him, he reciprocates in kind. That's another important teaching of Bhagavad Gita. As we take shelter of Krishna, he reciprocates. And it's for all living entities, not even those who are devoted to him. All living entities. Yayatamam prapadyante, tangstadaiva pajamyaham, Krishna says. All living entities. So the amongst all living entities, those that are his devotees, they're special. And amongst his devotees, the resident of Vrindavan are super special. Because the intensity of their love. So that's what we've been hearing. And then just kind of on the side, a routine thing is killing of demons. And the cowherd boys, they go back and say, guess what Krishna did today? Wow. And they compose songs and sing about what Krishna did today. As they thresh their wheat and milk the cows, and that's their life. Sometimes Krishna's pastimes are manifest, and sometimes they're unmanifest. But the pastimes, we hear from scripture, they're eternal. So sometimes they're shown to the world. And that's what's celebrated, is the pastimes. But then when they're withdrawn, or in the aprakat, unmanifest stage, we can meditate on them and hear about the manifest pastimes, knowing that Krishna is internally enjoying, and enter into that mood also. That's bhakti, the meditation of one who is serving Krishna. So you go through your worldly duties, exactly what Krishna says to Arjuna. perform your prescribed duty, and always think of me. So how we always think of Krishna depends on our relationship with Krishna. And it depends on our understanding of who he is and how to best be in service to him. But when we hear that these descriptions from Srimad Bhagavatam, we can understand perfect, more perfect, most perfect. The residents of Vrindavan are most perfect. So it's very pleasing to think of Krishna in those ways, even when we're doing our daily duties, whatever those things may be. We live in the world and develop consciousness of Krishna within and live our external life in accordance with those values that are Krishna-centered values. That's the life of devotion to Krishna. So let's see if there's some discussion. What we've been doing is, Peter, our host, so you can speak first, or if you have anything you'd like to ask, and then after we have some people in the room speak, then people can send in their text messages for online questions that goes on for a while. So any thoughts you'd like to share or discussion or anything? Whoa. Okay. Pretty strong introduction. Okay.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna.
I was part of Bhakti Vriksha, but I haven't completed reading Bhagavad Gita.
Okay.
But currently I'm reading Bhagavatam with Mataji.
Okay.
There are days when I feel very emotional and very connected, and there are days when I do not feel that connected.
Pendulum goes the other way.
So, I mean, is it that I'm not completely into it or?
No. What you just described is part of what's standard is called anishtata bhakti. Unsteady. Sometimes, like a sine curve. Sometimes, and sometimes. It's completely standard. Not like there's something wrong with you. It's just completely standard. Supposing someone has a disease, and the doctor diagnoses, they describe their symptoms, and he gives some medicine and some diet. So how long does it take for the disease to get back to normal? It could take a while. And sometimes they feel a little better and sometimes they feel a little weaker. And so the material condition of forgetfulness of who we really are and our Father, the source of all living entities, as Bhagavad Gita Krishna says, Bija Pratak Pita. He's the Pita. He's the Father of all living entities. So we forgot. That's part of our disease. We forgot who we are and who our Father is, who our eternal Father. So there's some medicine. Diagnosis and medicine and taking the medicine. It takes some time. And sometimes. So it's just restoring our healthy condition of consciousness in relation to who we are. And how, once we know who we are, to continue to live our life in a responsible manner, at the same time knowing who we are, in a deeper sense, not just the temporal sense. So there's nothing wrong. Just by understanding the material condition, that's, you know, learning about the disease. Wow. Pretty ecstatic. I had a medical condition without going into detail. that I was really determined. I wanted to know what was the cause so I could do something about what the cause was. And that, you know, they're saying what it wasn't, but I didn't know what it was. Once I found out what it was, then not only I could be more peaceful, but I could do something that would prevent it from recurring. Some things you can't, but some things you can. So, through reading Bhagavad Gita, you'll come to know why the living entity, you and others, all of us, are in a position of forgetfulness. Like, that's the disease. And what's the root cause? And what's the remedy? What's the medicine and the diet and the, you know, the activities that you should do and not do to get back the healthy condition? So that's gradual. Spiritual education is a gradual restoring of consciousness, not just information, it's consciousness. So it takes some time and gradual. And the sense of feeling connected is because that connection exists, spiritually speaking. We're just forgetful of it. And sometimes, it's like, you know, the weather. Sometimes it's overcast, sometimes it's sunny, sometimes it's stormy, sometimes it's winter. Sometimes it's, so, kadachit, sometimes. But the spiritual connection is to gradually move in that direction, and the darkness dissipates as you move towards light. That's how it works. You can verify it. You walk towards light, darkness is dispelled. It takes some time. So allow it to take some time. Be kind to yourself. Let it take some time. And just keep following the medicine and diet and, you know, wholesome activities. Avoid things that disturb the diseased condition, aggravate it, and do the things that are nourishing to that healthy condition. And you'll start to feel more connected more often. Then it just becomes, that's just standard. And then, you know, be prepared. You'll find as you go along, there's deeper networks of coverings that you didn't even know were there. And then, you know, subtle things that then become, you know, you have to work on that. And that making the heart clean takes time and patience and perseverance and, you know, and that being connected through good guidance and so forth. We don't know what's going on. Maybe we should do without the microphone. Yeah. Technology's great when it works. And it's a little annoying when it doesn't. Would you like to add anything, or we'll come back to you later?
Yeah, we'll come back to
me. Okay, fine. So she has some online questions. And she's going to speak nice and loud.
So this is from Rupa Sri Mataji from Naperville. Devaki and Vasudev had done penance for 12,000 years to get Krishna as their son. In this age of Kali, Sankirtan Yajna, Nama Yajna is the most powerful Yajna. By doing this Yajna, if one desires to have Krishna as their son, is that right?
Well, the question is a little, is it right to desire Krishna as one's son? That's the question, I think. Is Nam Yajna a method to become purified sufficient that Krishna can become one's son? It's a two-part question. And the answer is, why not? However, spiritual attraction and a material conception of what a spiritual attraction may not be the same. We may have a material conception of what I'm attracted to in the spiritual realm. However, every soul, just like, let's say here's a bag of seeds. And inside the bag of seeds, let's say it's marigold seeds. This one is orange and this one is yellow. And this one has big flowers and that one has little tiny flowers. And you don't know until you plant the seed. Now, some people that know a lot about seeds can tell you that's going to be a small flower and that's going to be a medium flower. It's going to be one of those big ones. But you won't really know until the seed sprouts. Then you know the color and this and the type and the variety and this and that. So that's a material example, but each soul has an eternal relation with Krishna. And we don't have the faculties, the capacity presently to know what is my eternal relationship with Krishna at the soul level. What's my spiritual form, swarup, and my spiritual activity in relation to Krishna eternally. That's covered now, so we don't know. It's like a seed, it's dormant. So the main, I would advise this devotee, take shelter of the holy name in Sankirtan, other purifying processes. You know, cook nicely for Krishna, not just cook nicely for the tongue, cook nicely for Krishna. Do all the things that you do with very special devotion. And then you await the cleansing so that you can understand more clearly what your eternal relation with Krishna is. May be that of a parental affection. It may be. And it may be something else and maybe something else. And you wait for that to become revealed to you or apparent to you by Krishna's mercy. He'll make those things become known as you become qualified to know. That's my suggestion.
And the second part of her question is, or third part of her question is, as it is said that the ultimate purpose of human life is to get back to Supreme Personality of Godhead, if Krishna comes as one son, does it matter if it's material planet or Krishna Loka?
It doesn't matter. You're so fortunate to have Krishna as your son, you can be anywhere you want to be, or anywhere he wants to be. May that day become yours. Go ahead.
The questions are not coming yet, Maharaj. Okay. I had a question.
Okay.
We were reading the 13th chapter of first canto. The Dhritarashtra quits home, that part.
You and she were reading?
Yeah, we have like a few other devotees joining. And somehow I was under the impression that Dhritarashtra did not go back home, back to Godhead. He only attained, his liberation was not very clear to me because he went and performed some austerities and then he just manifested fire and
yes.
So this time when we read in the purport, Prabhupada was saying that by the mercy of Vidura, Dhritarashtra amalgamated his intelligence himself into his intelligence and then saw that he was the same as Paramatma in quality, and he was accepted by Krishna so I was wondering what was his destination. I didn't understand that part, whether he really went back to Godhead or he was just
I'd have to go look at the commentaries to give you a definitive answer, but to go back to Godhead requires strong bhakti. And that was, he was an elevated person that got sidetracked from his elevation because of attachment. excessive attachment on the material side to his sons and his idea of he wanted to be the king. That's totally false ego. It's not eligibility for going back to Godhead. But so the destination of Dhritarashtra is not back to Godhead. I can say that just in principle. But you know, the question of where did he go, I'd have to see what the Acharyas said. The idea of amalgamating his intelligence and so forth and so on, those are standard steps in the Ashtanga Yoga process. Grandfather Bhishma did something similar. So we can understand that people at that time, they knew the Ashtanga Yoga process. He didn't have to go to a bunch of yoga classes, Dhritarashtra. He knew. Bhishma Dev knew. They knew that the qualified people knew and they were able to perform. So by Vidura's mercy, Dhritarashtra had to let go of the concept in his old days that I'm the king, although he was, you know, at his deathbed, or, you know, his teeth were falling out and his liver was not working and all those things he was saying. You know, the message is there. You're not going to stay here longer. So let go of this idea of being, I'm the ruler. Go to the forest. Do this Ashtanga Yoga process. And, you know, he did it with such intensity, as you said. The intensity of his meditation was such that his body burst into flames. That's pretty intense meditation. But he had that capacity. See, he was, in other words, he was a great soul that just got, you know, distracted big time. But he was a great soul, and Gandhari was a great soul. So he wasn't eligible to go back to Godhead because it was minus bhakti. He had received mercy of his younger brother, Vidura. But Vidura didn't teach him bhakti because he wasn't ready to receive bhakti. He was teaching him detachment. So where his soul went, it wasn't back to Godhead. But where his soul did go, I'd have to look carefully and see what our acharyas say.
So this question is from Giri Vattikotta Prabhu. These Krishna's pastimes are very attractive and sweet, keeps me attached while hearing. Once hearing is completed, pastimes stay a few hours to days and then disappear from my mind. Please help me how I can retain for longer time or forever.
Okay, well, two answers. Hear regularly because it's Kali Yuga and the memory is short, and it's Kali Yuga and consciousness is contaminated. So our attention by contamination goes to temporary, not to eternal. It's just, that's the our conditioning. That's this unsteady, the sine curve. So it just, by purification, by hearing regularly, then consciousness, the axis starts to go up. And the amplitude of the up and down starts to diminish. So when it starts to become steady. So that's how. And beyond steady is eternal. So there's practice stage, and then there's the purification that comes from practice, and then there's the purified, and then the completely pure stage. So that's what to do. Continue with the process of cleansing, purification, using this other metaphor, returning our good health from our diseased condition, and then remembrance is natural. It's spontaneous. You don't have to try for it. It's spontaneous. That's when we're pure. Okay, looks like we're done. Anything you want to bring up?
I actually have a question.
Okay.
Okay, so what I have is, I would say, rather a bad spiritual connection.
Okay.
Rather bad.
Okay.
And one of the reasons what I feel is that is how it is, because now all these verses and stories that we hear and we read and we go through them, they're from long, long time ago.
Yes.
And I'm sure the same things are happening in a different form right now in today's world. If I could connect, if there is something written or adapted to something with what is going on today that matches with what's written in Bhagavad Gita, for example, I think I would connect a lot more. So my question to you is, how can I get into this path of connecting more with spirituality? If I could get something that helps me understand the translation of these with the modern world.
Well, I can suggest three things right off. The three things have to do with the veracity, the validity of the Vedas. And it has to do with science. Because modern experiences, if science says, and science can demonstrate it, then I'm good. And if science can't verify it or demonstrate it, then I'm not sure I'm ready to go there. So, one of the areas of science, I'll give some European history. In Europe, there was a period of time when in Germany and in England and in Switzerland, in particular those three places, there was an awakening of interest in the ancient Vedas. And some people in those three places felt intimidated. Like specifically, their Christian roots were being challenged because if people start feeling there's like really good stuff over there, they may weaken in their Christianity convictions. So the intellectuals purposely challenged Vedas to cut that connection, to keep people within Christianity fold. It was just like political. And one of the main criticisms, there were persons, scholars that traveled around giving lectures on these two areas, where there's empiric information within the Vedas having to do with cosmology and having to do with the timing of things, because there's numbers, empirical data. So something that you may be interested in that's in today's world is there's the development of a Temple of Vedic Planetarium. It's got an acronym, TOVP. And it's a plan that's manifesting at, currently the plan is to open at least the worship part in a few years. And it's a humongous structure in the subcontinent of India, in West Bengal. And one part over here is going to be a planetarium. Planetarium means people can go in, and it's like a museum, and they can see the structure of the universe. Well, this is from the Vedic perspective. So there's been 2 or 3 decades worth of work of astrophysicists and people that have, degrees in what the world says about the structure of the universe and what the Vedas say about the structure of the universe, and putting together what the Vedas say about the structure of the universe and being able to explain it to people that know Western cosmology. Called the Temple of Vedic Planetarium. So, because I have a science background, I have an interest to be able to explain Vedic cosmology to people that don't have the training in the Vedas. So, without going into detail, because there's like that's hours worth of discussion on the detail, Vedic cosmology takes one beyond three-dimensional space. It's within three dimension. You can depict it in three dimension, but the structure of the universe is to be explained from the Vedic model beyond the three-dimensional space. And modern physics has such an idea, like, you know, space, three-dimensional space. And then there's another conception of space. That's the Vedic conception of space. It's a little mind-teasing, but it's modern. And the model, without going into details, the model, I'll give one example. In the Vedic conception of the structure of the universe, the model is geocentric. Sometime, and all the world had the model of geocentric. Copernicus came along and said, no, heliocentric. And then described cosmology based on sun is at the center of our solar system. And that's the current model in modern science. So he gave an explanation of the distance between the sun and the earth. And it was off by a factor of a few hundred. And then through development of technology, it got closer and closer and closer and closer to the Vedic depiction of the distance between the earth and the sun. And et cetera, et cetera. You know, all the other planets in our solar system. So now, question. How did the people in Vedic culture have their numbers so precise when they didn't have technology? It depicts the structure of the universe in empiric detail, very precise, very specific. And modern science has gotten closer and closer and closer to the Vedic numbers. So how did they get those numbers? From where did those numbers come without technology? So they had access to some higher source of information. Descending knowledge. And that picture describes, you know, the seasons and the eclipses and motions of planets and so forth and so on. The model's a different model, but it explains all that. So, yeah. So so the people that came up with all those numbers are not people that are interested in fairy tales. Mythology, you know, children's stories. It doesn't prove anything. It just, the inference is there's something going on here that's deeper than, you know, I want to find out something more about this thing. You know, the wisdom of these people that knew all these empiric details. Here's another. It's not proof of anything, but it's an indication. This is the modern experience. There are two people I know, because of time, I won't go into the detail, but someone very dear to them experienced the Yamadutas. So the Yamadutas are spoken of in the Vedas. I'll tell one story. There's two that I'm aware of. There's a family in San Diego, and a dear friend of mine is the responsible for that center, ISKCON Center in San Diego. There was an elderly couple who, the wife was very devoted and the husband was kind of like, he drove his wife to the temple and he'd sit in the car and she'd come back into the car or the program and he'd go home. He was not like against. He just didn't have any attraction. But the family was, the devotees were affectionate to the family. So he got some critical disease and went into a coma. This is like 6-7 years ago, not so long ago. During this period of time that he was in coma, relatives came from all around the world, and because he was a wealthy and influential, person. He was in coma for quite some time. I forget, 20 days or something like that. And then one day, the devotees were there having kirtan. And one day, he opened his eyes and looked around the room. And his first words were, "They came." And the relatives had said, "Yes, we came because you were..." He said, no. "They came." And the devotee said, "Yes, we've been here doing kirtan." And he said, no, "They came." Because my friend had told him before he went into coma, he's in the hospital, said, "This may be it. You better fix your mind on Krishna. You better fix your mind on Krishna because Bhagavad Gita says wherever the mind is at the time of death, that's where you go." So he said, no, "They came." And he described the Yamadutas. And they came three times. "They came to take me away." And I said, "No, I want to be with Krishna." And then as soon as I said Krishna, they went away. And then they came back again and they were going to take me. And I said, "No, I want to be with Krishna." And they went away. It happened three times. And now I want to give my life to Krishna. Something. I may have some of the details not exactly correct, but he saw the Yamadutas and he described them as the scripture describes them. He wasn't a believing man, but he experienced by the mercy of the devotees and his good wife and whatever. And he took it to heart what this, senior devotee said, "You better become attached to Krishna because wherever you're attached to, that's where you're going to go." Then in Russia, very similar story. A girl and her father and father passing, and he saw the Yamadutas. He described them. He hadn't read about them in scriptures, but his description of what he saw was the Yamadutas. And he had affection for his daughter, so he thought of his daughter. And, as he thought of his daughter, as they were coming, they went away. And he came out of his coma. So, I'm trying to be responsive to your question. Those are events, you have to go interview this fellow in San Diego and this older man in Russia. To find, what happened. What was the real story? Not just what your daughter said or a nice storyteller said, but what really happened. You could do that, try to do that, but those are examples. And a third example is becoming popularized. People remembering their previous lives. Past life remembrance or out of body experiences, OBEs. those things. Mm-hmm. And details and details and details from people in modern situation, doctors that were like, reincarnation is silly. But, there's one doctor has written a book because it happened in Atlanta at the university at Emory University Medical School. He is a surgeon. And the patient told him after the open heart surgery where he had cardiac arrest, what happened during cardiac arrest. And the doctor was, what? You know, this person came in and said this and turned on this machine and someone broke down crying and they left the room and, you know, details of what happened during his cardiac arrest, which can't happen, you know, because consciousness in the Western medicine is blood goes to the brain and then there's electrochemical events and synapses. And when the blood flow stops, the whole machine stops. You can't be aware of anything. But the person was up above the operating room, the table, and looking down and reported back to the doctor the next day everything that happened. He said, like, whoa, wait a minute. There's got to be an explanation for this. And so he started consulting and did, you know, 12 years, some number of years of research, and then wrote a book, Out of Body Experiences. And it's like there's dozens of those. Somebody in the state of Washington, Dr. Kimberly something, same. So what is it? Consciousness is different than the body. That's not what medicine teaches. I mean, that was medical students. Not what medicine teaches. But, so what is it? What is it? It's not proof, but the seat of consciousness is not the body. So then, that's what the Vedas teach. The seat of consciousness is the soul. So now what about the rest of the stuff that the Vedas teaches? It doesn't prove anything. There's reason to look into this. Recently, an American family, and this is so maybe 5 years ago, their son was fascinated with airplanes. It's like this whole commentary and, you know, YouTube videos of the family, that nice Christian family that never heard anything about. And it turns out their son remembered being a pilot of an airplane during World War II and the Japanese, and he, you know, how he died. And, you know, they went and researched and found out that, you know, his son's name was such and such in his previous life. And he was remembering all those things with details about nomenclature of equipment in an airplane and types of airplanes. And he's just a little boy. He had those remembrances of his previous life, et cetera, et cetera. You know, hundreds of those things. Hundreds of those things. So there's some veracity in the spiritual principle, giving these just three examples, that just one, like stories and structure of the universe and the soul. So what's there in modern, your question, what's there in modern times that tells us there's something of validity here? Now, Krishna's pastimes are accessible in his Prakat Lila, his manifest pastimes, from time to time. Scheduled incarnations, it's called in the Bhagavatam. So if you want to see Krishna's pastimes, you're going to have to wait till the schedule comes. But, you know, the validity of what he says can be examined in our modern times. That's the beginning. You know, our modern life, myself included, through training in science and mathematics, you know, there's that was my field, heading for medicine. That's how you know things, and you become good at knowing things by that methodology. And so that same methodology can teach us things that are beyond what empiric research can verify. It's not a proof, but there's something that's beyond the gaze of our senses to examine. So it's then something that's non-physical or non-three-dimensional. Something that helps is, you know, to go forward from the position that you described is, I want to know. I mean, if there's another position you could say, I'm not really interested. But if there's something, the curiosity factor that says, here's something that's, you know, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, I'd like to get a deeper understanding of this. Then, you know, that prompt, that I want to know prompt, jigyasu, inquisitiveness leads, you know, there's paths to follow or strings to follow. You've pulled this string and something over there moves. So how did that happen? And it's, you know, like a little boy learning how to. I was staying, before coming here, I was in Palatine. In the house, there's a teenage boy, and he bought a little kit, and he built a 8-cylinder engine in his living room. You know, powered by a battery. But, you know, he learned how this fit together with that fit together, and the cylinders go up and down. There's no gas and oil, and that's just showing how the machine works, because he has a curiosity. Naturally, you know, I don't have such a curiosity for machines and 8-cylinder engine. But so if there's curiosity to understand, that which is beyond the gaze of my senses, and there's some information, empiric information, that says there's something deeper going on here. I want to know more about that something deeper going on here. That's the beginning. So take any one of those things and learn something more about those things, and it leads to other things. We have some online questions. Go ahead.
So this is Rupa Mataji again. Parikshit Maharaj, when he was given the warning of his death in 7 days, he made the best use of it. He freed himself from the material attachment and surrendered completely to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Is it possible for a human being in today's world to get liberated, as in going back to Krishna, if they make the best use of their time in the last few days of their life, if they know how much time they have, though not being completely immersed in Krishna consciousness till then?
Not very likely. Certainly it's possible, but not very likely. Now, Maharaj Parikshit, prior to the last 7 days of his life, he was, even before he was born, he was a recipient of mercy from Krishna. And his whole life was glorious and devoted to Krishna. So what he was able to accomplish at the final stage is very special. And now, can something, her question is, can that be somehow matched or, you know, comparable in some way or another if one hasn't to live their life that way? Not very likely. It, you know, the notion is, yes, it's possible, but the fact is the mind's going to go to the temporary by habit. Like this unsteady up and down. The mind's going to go there just by habit. So it's not so likely. But possible, sure.
This question is from Sanchari Mataji. A slightly random question. I have heard that demigods wait to take birth in Kali Yuga because going back home is much simpler in this age. This puzzles me greatly because it seems like the opposite is true. In bygone ages, the distinctions between what's good and bad was clear, whereas in this age, everything is blurred and sometimes can make the obstacles faced in devotional service overwhelming. Did the demigods mean this in the literal sense or as a way to pacify and uplift us?
Well, I don't recall it saying taking birth in Kali Yuga. I recall it saying taking birth on earth. Because the heavenly planet's too much enjoyment, the hellish planet's too much suffering, the earth is neither too much suffering, too much enjoyment. So it's the opportunity facility is special or opportune or something like that. But it's not Kali Yuga. It's not being too attracted to sense enjoyment, not being too much miserable by material circumstance.
Neeraj Bhatnagar Prabhu's question, is past life hypnotic regression, also something which might indicate reincarnation?
Yes. I have some video clips of people remembering details and details and details and then the hypnotist taking them to those places and sure enough it's just as they described. You know, it's not a proof because there could be different explanations, but it's very unlikely that there's any other explanation. Then that soul that's in such and such body remembers their previous life, several generations even ago. There's one, a lady in Australia that had never been out of Australia, was in a hypnotic trance, remembering her previous life in a certain place in England, and then another in a certain place in Normandy with a certain dialect, and the person was speaking in that Normandy dialect. So the hypnotist had to bring in somebody who knew the Normandy dialect, and she remembered exactly where she was married, where the church was, where the this was, and where the street was, and on and on, and all kinds. And so they went there and they saw the church, or they went there and they saw the place where this lady had grown up and what the stone. Anyway, it's not possible that somebody just imagined these things. It's somewhere stored in the memory. There's another example.
This is from Radhika, Kirti Prabhu's daughter.
How old is she?
She's 10, 9 or 10, I think.
Okay.
Krishna's name is non-different from Krishna. If it is so, how do we have Nama Prabhu? So when we are chanting, are we calling Krishna or Nama Prabhu?
Both. Why not? Because they're non-different. Why did it have to be this one instead of that one or that one instead of this one? They're non-different.
This question is from Hema Suryavanshi Mataji. How to manage future anxieties and fears? Should we leave it to Krishna and not worry about that?
She's from India. Indoor. depends. You have to have a plan in life. And you make plans that are reasonable and not obsessive, just reasonable. And at the same time, you have to rely on Krishna. So it's not like either or. Some things are just, they don't carry the same prominence or importance, and so they're in the back burner. And you're waiting to see, what's the best way to deal with something, and you just remain patient. And some things they need immediate attention, they're priority, and so you make a plan, but you're depending upon Krishna. So in either case, you're depending on Krishna for inspiration. You're dependent on Krishna for verification. We're dependent upon Krishna for being successful in even ordinary activities of life, what to speak of spiritual ones. So you make a plan, you look to Krishna for guidance, intelligence, and strength to carry out the plan. You know, in different categories depending on the circumstance. Okay?
So Neeraj Prabhu is asking back, is it safe to do hypnotic regression to find who we are in our past life?
No. I don't advise it. I mean, it can be done, but I don't advise it. It's not dangerous. I just don't advise it. It's just curiosity. Who was I? I don't advise it. Supposing you find out, then what? Okay, we're done. Thank you very much, Prabhupada.